Hey, what is going on, Los Angeles? It's J-Dot, T-Dot, and I hope that you are very well. Today is Friday, December 8th, 2023, and on this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast, yours truly is in conversation with Councilmember Hernandez of the 1st District. That's right, LA City Councilmember Hernandez of the 1st District. So it's a special episode in which we discuss rent hikes coming up in February, the impact of rent hikes in Council District 1, the LA Ethics Commission endorsing Isabel Jurado in the 14th District, for the race coming up there this March just as well, and so much more. Please refer to the show notes as necessary, and if you haven't done so just yet, subscribe to the show, follow the show. It's just the best way to support yours truly. And if you're already following or subscribed to the show, but you haven't yet reviewed it, well, it would be just the best holiday gift for yours truly. With that said, stay vigilant and stay tuned. Until the next time, it's J-Dot, T-Dot. Out with more soon. It's Jimbo times. Let's just dive right on into it. Councilmember Hernandez, thanks so much for joining me on JT the LA Storyteller podcast today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me today, JT.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I think it's an important time to connect with you, especially because just next week, I think it's like next Tuesday, that marks a full year since you took city council office, since you were sworn in. So this feels really on the mark for me with respect to that.
Yes, you know, we had a conversation during the campaign, and now we're having a conversation after our first year, so I think it's really impactful, and it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to share what we've done.
Yes, of course, and I really value this because there's so much going on throughout our city, throughout our county, throughout the world at this time, and I feel like it's necessary to talk about LA City Hall and what is going on with city governance and what is going on with city resources and where we are and the fights that are still ahead for us, because there's a lot coming, including in an election year for our communities.
An election year, rent debt is due.
Yes.
Rent is going to increase for thousands upon thousands of people. It's a lot happening next year.
That's exactly right. So you mentioned it yourself. Why don't we talk a little bit about the rent hike? The rent hike that is coming as soon as this February, which is anywhere from 4% to 6%. Tell us a little bit about that for folks who might be hearing about this for the first time just now. What is going on in February 2024 with respect to rent everywhere in Los Angeles?
Yes, JT. So rent, there was a motion that passed to increase rent for RSO units, which is rent stabilized ordinance units, which oftentimes are single rooms, which oftentimes are held by some of our community members who are the lowest income or fixed income, like our seniors. And so this motion has been passed and is getting approved in its final form to take place in February, which is a 4% to 6% increase on rent for RSO, for these types of units in particular, not for other units, RSO units, which is 4% to 6% might not sound like a lot to people, but when you're a senior and you're on fixed income SSI, you're already running on a tight budget, and it could put you in the place, which I've heard from many people, that it's going to have them having to decide, am I going to be able to buy the bus pass? Or am I going to be able to buy food? Or do I have to put all my money into rent? And this is happening, unfortunately, on the same day, on the same month, that people who owe back rent from COVID-19 have to pay that back rent. And I've met people who owe thousands upon thousands of dollars who are not going to have the money to get out of that hole. I mean, I still haven't even finished paying off my student loans. And so how are we expecting people to be able to pay all that back rent? We had an emergency renters assistance program that was launched by the housing department this year. Within the first 2 days, there was already millions and millions and millions of dollars in requests for rental assistance. And so I have a lot of concerns about what will be happening in February, and we need to really come together as like elected officials with community to figure out how we can move a solution forward, because thousands of families could be put at the brink of eviction or eviction.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about how this is going to impact your district, the first district.
The first district, yes. So we are a district where we're 60% tenants, renters. Our northern part of the district is much more single family homes. But within that part, there's also RSO units. Most of our apartments lie in the south, on the southern end of the district, which is also our lowest income part of the district. Our district, the part of the district where we have mostly migrant families, monolingual Spanish speakers, Cantonese speakers, a lot of seniors. The average median income in Chinatown is $15,000 a year, $15,000 to $17,000 a year. And so when I talk about these people that I've met that owe rent, like, this has been in CD1. We are in the top six, I believe, in districts that have received some of the most eviction filings in this year. District 14 being the number one in eviction filings. But for our district, the impact of rent increases, it could potentially be catastrophic.
That's right. That's right. So, of course, in this case, you're describing a scenario where more likely than not, you're going to have a number of people, as you said, making these difficult decisions as to whether they can afford the bus pass, maybe even groceries for the month as groceries continue to go up in price. And if it comes down to it, you're going to have more and more folks that are on the street at a time when the city's already under a lot of pressure from people everywhere to fix this more often than not. So it feels like a serious step in the wrong direction. And for folks looking from the outside in, it feels as though the city is moving in a direction that is just absolutely contradictory to the needs on these streets and through these neighborhoods right now.
Yeah, and I think what people have to understand, and what I hope that the housing movement understands, is that the lack of power in community that is putting pressure on the government is having the government move this way. You know, you have a lot of my colleagues on the council who have run campaigns, who have taken different types of money, and that shows in the votes. That shows who has their ear. Some special interest groups are stronger than others. Some housing groups are stronger than others. And those people are making their way into City Hall. I think what I would like to say to that is I really hope that the housing movement comes together, because it's going to take a tremendous amount of power to break this camel's back. Because this camel right now is headed towards rent increases, to back rent being due, and to expanding the eviction to homelessness pipeline. And I don't see that changing unless there is a tsunami wave of community and tenants and the housing movement really coming together to define their goals and push. And I know that there's a lot of also mistrust, and people are tired of electoral politics. They're tired of the council moving in this way. Now there's new people. This election season is next year, and there could be a potential even more better people. And now is not the time to really disengage. Now is the time to push even harder. So that's the call that I make. Like, yes, it's scary what's coming up, and if we don't get our stuff together and really come together and build that community power and bring it into City Hall, I don't foresee things changing.
Right, right. And I think that's key candor in this moment, right? I think that being upfront with your community as well as that movement about the needs going forward is something that's been sorely missing from a lot of these discussions between activists and city leaders or community leaders. And so what you're saying is that the people power really needs to amp up in order for these representatives to make the decision that is consistent with fixing this crisis.
100%. And I know people are going to be upset that I say that, because they're like, then what did we elect you for? I hear you, but there are 14 other council members. I can't change things with the flick of a wrist. It takes a majority. And so we have to lobby and push the majority to move in this way.
Yeah. With respect to the majority, there was this vote earlier in May that made a lot of headlines, the mayor's budget. You were the sole representative who voted against this budget. This is something that I think folks need to understand in terms of your aligning yourself with the abolitionist movement and being consistent with that. So can you just say a little bit about why you were the sole vote on this council to stand against the police budget?
Yes, I voted no for the police budget because most of my work that I've done around the criminal justice system abolition has been about money, has been about moving money, reducing the money, reassessing the money, because it's money that gives these institutions more power. And so for most of my work, I've tried to move money out of the carceral system. I've been pushing bureaucracy to stop putting so much money in the carceral system. Worked on campaigns like Measure J to move money and make sure the carceral system couldn't access that money. So when I got into City Hall, I said, I'm not going to vote for a budget that gives any new money to the police. And from the jump, I said that to everybody. And this budget was the first budget cycle we came into midway. We had a lot of learning to do. But at the end of it, we got a lot of wonderful things from the budget. The mayor gave a lot of our districts a lot of great things. But at the end of the day, we put nearly a quarter of our budget into one department, which is LAPD. I have to tell my constituents, no, I can't do what you're asking me to do because there's no resources for it. Why? Because we give a quarter of it to LAPD. And so I voted no because my shiro says, which is Supervisor Holly Mitchell, that a budget is a statement of your values. And when a quarter of our budget is going to one department, LAPD, that's not matching the values that we have as a city. And people are telling me they don't feel safe. Ma'am, you just spent 15 minutes at your door telling me you don't feel safe walking your child to school. But in no other moment in history have we given the LAPD more money than we do today. Mm-hmm. Yes, I want to reassess the budget. And so that's why I voted no. And I have to navigate that because that does come with impacts. It comes with internal impacts of like, well, am I going to get short-handed the next budget cycle? Potentially. But it's important, I think. I couldn't just throw away all the work that I had done in advocacy work around, you know, funding and things like that. And I felt at this moment that I hadn't done enough labor to reduce the amount of money, so I could not vote yes.
Right. And I think of Lincoln Heights, for example, with its proximity to downtown LA and the generations of people who you are well familiar with that have seen this police budget year after year inflicting harm on their communities, sending folks to jail, sending folks to long stints of time, robbing them of the opportunity to find meaningful employment and upward mobility of any sort. So that vote is very much a vote that is in line with knowing CD1 and what communities in CD1, including in Lincoln Heights, but also throughout, have seen for far too long, for generations before you and I were on the scene.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And like my constituents, the community members of CD1, are asking me to clean the streets. They're asking me to trim the trees, fix the sidewalks. They want clean places to walk through. They want their parks enhanced.
They want to keep their small businesses.
Yes, exactly. They want to keep their small businesses open. They don't want to have to walk around people experiencing homelessness because people should be housed. And we cannot do the things at those levels that they're demanding because our budget doesn't call for that.
So with respect to the budget, with respect to the needs of your communities versus also the needs of the city, there was the purchase of the Mayfair Hotel, mm-hmm. which has also seen millions of dollars in investment for cleanup, for basic repairs, if anything. And the Mayfair Hotel is, of course, located in the MacArthur Park Westlake area, and it is set to house folks probably coming from the downtown side. We might say CD14, but this is in your district now, in CD1, and you made a note about new investments in housing needing to be prioritized for people who live within the community, including in CD1. Mm-hmm. And so you noted that this hotel is not that. So there were complications in that moment between needs for, we might say, the broader city, including even the neighboring district, but also needs that your folks are just as entitled to as anyone else. Can you shed some light on this and why it was essentially a complication for you?
Yes, it was a complication for me because I really believe in what the mayor is trying to do around creating a single, like, unified strategy on how to address homelessness in the city of Los Angeles. I believe in that. I think we need to do that. We need to fully fund that. What's been happening right now has been very piecemeal. Some districts respond in a more carceral way. our district is not responding in that way. But that doesn't mean we're not trying to address the issue. We just need more housing, more access to rooms, and supportive services. The Mayfair is an example of the things that we need to keep building throughout the city of LA to really support folks and add to the housing stock. But at the same time, the MacArthur Park and Westlake community is a yes community. They're like, yes, build permanent supportive housing here. Yes, build deeply affordable housing here. Yes, build reentry programs and reentry housing here. You go MacArthur Park and Westlake, there's all that type of housing, and particularly around the Mayfair, there's a ton of permanent supportive housing. And so that's why I also introduced amendments to say, okay, if you're going to bring the Mayfair here, then you need to give us $400,000 annually for street cleaning teams. You need to give us access to beds and to hotels through the Inside Safe program or through other opportunities. You need to help us create a task force of small businesses and community members that can continue to be a task force around the Mayfair so that they can talk about what their issues are, work together to fix them. That's why I put those amendments in, because we should be celebrating and we should be rewarding neighborhoods that say yes to these things. So it was difficult because, you know, it is going to house for the first 2 years people from the Grand Hotel and CD14 and Skid Row.
Right.
But again, I think that overall, the fact that we're trying to create an overall strategy and that we got these things for our community, I think that's where it was a good compromise that we had made to house people.
Right. So there's a tension between the city's needs overall and also what districts are, what kind of tactics districts are employing mm-hmm. to basically relieve the number of unhoused folks on these streets. And so people need to see that the city is constantly in conversation with the rest of the constituency. So we cannot just pin everything on one district or a few of them. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a citywide, countywide approach, which is something that we knew going into this just as well, but which is becoming increasingly apparent mm-hmm. as we go along.
Yeah, the need is so great everywhere.
Yeah. So speaking of needs and speaking of also introducing a new approach to some extent, you actually hosted earlier this year Denver's team-assisted response to people experiencing mental crises or crises of other sorts. Can you tell us a little bit about hosting this delegation and why you did that, why you brought folks out from Denver into CD1 to consider a new approach to these crises?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I really believe that, you know, as a city, we're behind on being able to address a lot of these crises and issues through an innovative policies, responses. And so I explore things across the country that are working, that are benefiting people. I've studied drug decriminalization in Portugal. I've studied diversion programs in Seattle. I've studied street responses in Portland and alternate crisis response in Denver, because these jurisdictions are just doing things better than we are. And we brought Denver Star because part of the work I did in the past as an advocate was to try to build out alternate crisis response teams. Some are called psychiatric mobile response teams. There's different names to these things, but essentially these are teams that when someone's having a mental health crisis, that instead of calling 911 and getting the police, you call 911 and you get the appropriate team that can de-escalate the situation, provide psychotropic medication to the person, talk them down from the crises. That is alternate crisis response. And the reason why we brought in Denver like so quickly, because this is one of my ultimate goals, building a citywide alternate crisis response system attached to 911. But we didn't get time to work our way into it because in January we had Takar Smith that was killed by LAPD in our district. Takar Smith was having a mental health crisis, and his wife did everything she could to let responders know he's having a mental health crisis and it's bad. They ended up killing him in his kitchen. And so that situation in January, as soon as we got in, is what really revved up our work of doing outreach to Denver. Because I went over there, I studied their program. And so I was like, they exist, let's bring them. And we brought them to show the rest of the council members, cities and counties can build city-wide responses to these crises. They can be attached to 911. They don't have to be what are called co-responder teams. It doesn't need to be a cop and a clinician. It can just be a clinician over 5,000 calls in Denver, and at one time have had to use the police when responding to a mental health crisis. So that's why I brought them, to show our, my colleagues, like, we can do this. It's happening everywhere else. And it also, we had to do it so quickly because of the loss of Takar Smith.
Right. We're supposed to have a program for this already, the Circle program, which I know is in Hollywood and a few other parts. It may be in Lincoln Heights, but why is it that we don't just take the Circle program and expand that outwards?
That's a great question. And I think part of that is happening now. But I also want to be very clear that Circle is a homelessness response. It's tailored and talked about as a homelessness response. That's great. Now, when we think about our response system, I think about it as steps. So step one is the lowest level of crisis response, or just low-level response, which USC Street Medicine could do. And we have one of those that we got in this budget cycle, which is doctors from USC, nurses who can give psychotropic medication, do wound care, make sure people are okay. They're like pre-crises and they're post-crises. So after someone comes out of the hospital or jail, like, they will go and engage them. That's level one. Level two response is psychiatric mobile response teams, for example, which are clinician led by psychiatric doctors or nurses or community health workers all together. And they actually go to respond to calls from someone who's like speaking gibberish in the middle of the sidewalk or walking around without their clothes. Like, they deal with that level of crises. And then level three of crisis response or emergency response is the police and the firefighters. And so we have to build these steps. Right now, everything just goes to step three. Circle is part of like level one and two, but it's tailored to homelessness. And so we got to think about because we've talked about expanding Circle. And I think a few things for that, it's like, if they're going to expand, it's great because they're already connected to 911. It's not fully embedded into the technological system, but it's embedded with the dispatchers. So how do we get it citywide? But how do we also get culturally humble organizations that'll be the responders to those calls, because it just can't be one org. I think it has to be very particular to the areas. And how do we build out the other steps of response? Because Circle's great, but again, if it's only going to be for people experiencing homelessness, then we're missing a large window of people.
Wow, and it seems to me, as you mentioned this, that especially because it's already integrated into LAPD's system, if LAPD is set to receive raises over the next couple of years, to the extent that they have, then part of that money should be allocated towards increasing services for this program. But of course, most of that budget is heading towards raises for the police. Mm-hmm. So as to, in their logic, or according to their arguments, increase the salary and make LAPD more competitive. But that, we know, is of course an argument, something that they continually wage, but that we see far past, because we know that these systems are in need right now, not in a future scenario, not in a theoretical place, as LAPD's argument relies on.
Yeah, and the wild thing is that our PSRs, our police service responders, they're the ones, the dispatchers who answer the 911 calls. They are within the LAPD department, yet they're not getting any of those benefits.
Right
now, all our PSRs are doing tremendous hour, like, numbers of hours of overtime. They're not getting breaks. Like, I visited the dispatching center, and it looks like a huge room where they do, you know, the stock market room and wherever they do it.
Sure.
That's what it looks like, with a bunch of computers, but it's like 20% full. Meaning that if there was a catastrophe to happen in the city of LA, we wouldn't even have enough 911 dispatchers to answer those calls. And so part of also this work is, like, we have to enhance. Like, I wish some of that $1 billion was going to the PSRs, because we have to hire more of them and we have to pay them more. They are literally some of the first responders that aren't even considered first responders by government. So they don't get benefits like some of these other departments do. So that's another thing that we're working on, is like, how do we help enhance and create a dynamic dispatching system? Because you can make all the teams you want, but if your dispatch system is not dynamic and capable, then the wrong people are still going to keep going to these calls.
That's right. It's understaffed and overworked. And yes. Then people call in, and what they receive or what they perceive is that the city has failed to invest in this program, which is supposed to be an alternative, yeah, which is supposed to save lives at mm-hmm. the end of the day. Because you mentioned Smith. Mm-hmm. These are lives on the line. People's lives mm-hmm. depend on how we engage this issue. Mm-hmm. So with respect to this, with respect to reforming the system or introducing a new way, especially with respect to the carceral system, there is the old Lincoln Heights jail mm-hmm. that you and your team are looking at. Tell me a little bit about the story behind remaking this space for CD1 and its constituents.
Yeah, so the Lincoln Heights jail has been sitting empty for a long time. It was a jail, and then it was shut down, and then they put community programs in there, such as a boxing program, and now it's just sitting empty, full of bird poop with asbestos. And there has been many plans to try to do something with it. In 2017, there was an RFP that went out. Different developers applied to do something with the building. And I remember one of them was Works, and they had applied to make it affordable housing, daycare, employment, like a beautiful plaza. And there was another developer that during the same meeting was like, well, we're going to keep some of the bars for the aesthetics. And it's like, that's, you know, and I think the Works didn't get it. It was one of the other developers that wanted to build like Amazon, like working spaces and things like that. But the cost was too high. So now it's just sitting there. So what my team and I have done is put a motion forward to get answers on what it'll cost to demolish it or to renovate it. Whatever is the cheapest option is the one we want to go to. I prefer to tear it down. This is a institution that represents the disappearance of many of our community members, the incarceration of many of our community members, the homophobia that has been against a lot of our community members, the Zoot Suit riots, all of that, you know, that was a place for those people. And so I would like to tear it down and build social housing there, build daycare there, build employment opportunities, green spaces. So that's the ultimate goal. You know, I visited Vienna earlier this year and saw the thousands of developments that had gone up, where it's like at the lower level of the development, it's an elementary school, a little healthcare center, a cafe, a store, and then everything else was just social housing units. And so that's my goal. We're going to tear it down and we're going to put social housing on there. And if people think social housing sounds wild, Google it. Look at what Vienna's doing. People in Vienna don't worry about their housing. People in Vienna don't have to worry how they're going to pay their rent. What they're thinking about is like, cool, I pay my rent. Now I have all this extra money. What am I going to do with it? They travel. They don't stress like we do here. I want to create more opportunities like that for our community.
Well, we were really talking about budgets at the top of our convo and moving money around, shifting funds around, including the way that this is how you essentially came into the political scene in Los Angeles to begin with. So maybe we can talk a little bit about Measure J's progress over the last year in particular, because there was obviously the passage, 2.1 million voters said, yes, let's end this diversion of funds, or let's begin to divert funds from the sheriff's office to preventative programs. Mm-hmm. Then it was, of course, stalled because litigation does that. Mm-hmm. I've heard the term lawfare more recently, and I can definitely see how that is increasingly an option or a tool that a lot of these private interests deploy against measures and progressive programs like these. Tell me a little bit about Measure J's progress going forward, because it was found by a court of appeals to be absolutely within the voters' rights to make this demand of their LA County board.
Yes, so like you said, it passed in November of 2020. December of 2020, there was a lawsuit that was driven by the county group unions, which is law enforcement unions, essentially. Judge Mary J. Strobel agreed with them and made Measure J and invalidated it and made it unconstitutional. We appealed. We got the support. When I say we, that's when I was with the Reimagine LA Coalition. We got resources to appeal that case. And so we appealed it, and it took them until this year to get a panel of three judges to rule that Measure J was constitutional. And I just wanted to repeat that process because we won, the voters won, and then the police were trying to undermine that win. The judges tried to undermine that win. And at the end, it was validated. And up to this point, over $500 million have been distributed in our tax dollars, of our tax dollars, to programs for young people, more mental health services, more drug treatment, more supporting and keeping people in their homes. Measure J wasn't just criminal justice. Measure J was a coalition that was built. Reimagine LA was a coalition that was built from people working on issues around street vendors to people working on youth justice to abolition to housing, affordable housing, and more. And I think that's why it resonated so well with everybody. And $500 million is nothing to scoff at. Like, that money would have never been in community, would have never gone to these things if it wasn't for the voters making it happen. And so it's the first time, I think, out of a couple of times that we've been successful in our budget advocacy work, because it's so hard to move the money. But it's, you know, if we want to actually meet the needs of our communities, we have to go get it. And I really hope, and I'm putting it into the universe, of like doing something like that at the local level.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, with respect to moving the money, you introduced a motion just last week, a really interesting motion regarding the Ethics Commission and independent funding for the Ethics Commission. And so there have been a lot of folks over the past couple of years, especially interested in LA City Hall's ethics program. And basically, it's lack of efficacy and its lack of independence. Can you say a little bit more about introducing this motion and how you view this as a natural step forward if the city is to abide by an actual empowered ethics commission?
Yes, I thought it was really wild that we have control over the budget of the department that's supposed to hold us accountable. Like, you know, what if you get upset at one of the commission members, or what if you get upset at the ethics department? You can probably do work to try to reduce their budget. And I don't know how many times that's occurred. I'm sure that there have been efforts. Look at the number of colleagues that I've had that have been, had had some sort of case on them, conviction, or complaint against them. We really need to do what we can to create an independent department with an independent budget that can hold us accountable. We, you know, myself and others, like City Controller Kenneth Mejia, all ran on trying to bring more transparency into government, on trying to bring more light into the work that is happening here. And this motion was part of that, to create more transparency, but also, like, let's cut this conflict of interest. Because I feel conflicted that I got to vote on the budget of a department, up or down, a department that has to oversee me and hold me accountable.
Yeah, absolutely. I will definitely post some links in the show notes for listeners to learn more about that. Thank you, council member. I want to ask you a little bit about expanding LA City Council, maybe even as soon as 2026. You all discussed this as well last week, but you didn't quite arrive to a number. However, there's another meeting in January where we may just be getting a real update as to placing this on the ballot for folks. But maybe you can say just a little bit about how it's not necessarily as simple as the magic wand creating more council members' offices.
Yes, you know, this process doesn't happen often. It's probably going to be another 50 years that we get to do this again. So I really believe that we need to do this right, and we need to have information to make the appropriate decisions on the number of council members. I 100% think that we need to expand our council. I represent over 264,000 people. And I get about $2 million to build a team to do that. And that is still not enough to meet the needs of all the requests coming in. So I think that if people want more access, if they want more representation, and if they want more delivery of constituent services, we need to figure out how we can expand that. Now, I think, like I said, we need to do this right, and we need to figure out what the appropriate number is going to be moving forward that we can afford, that we can, like, manage, particularly around the constituent services piece. Because I right now, we have thousands of vacancies in the city of LA, which means that it takes us 7 to 10 years to fix a sidewalk, 3 to 5 years to put in a blue handicap curb. And we don't even have enough resources or people to put in speed bumps at the rates that we need. The application closes within minutes off, like, right, Chelsea? The last time the speed bump application opened. And so I have concerns about how we're going to meet that, but that's not enough of a big concern not to move this forward. I think handing this off to a charter reform committee is what we need to do, because it's another point of conflict of interest, right? Like, similar how we would make an independent budget for the ethics department, we need to create an independent body, which is the Charter Reform Commission, to decide what some of these things look like. Because I think right now we have too much power and too much thumb opportunity to weigh it down in our favor. And if people really want independent process, then I think we need to create that independent process. And I think we can do it with urgency. You know, I think that charter reform can do their work quickly, but we need to prioritize that. So I'm not opposed to expansion. I think we need it. I think we need to do it right. And we need to have an independent charter reform commission, make some of these decisions, because it just it also feels like another moment of a conflict of interest.
Right, right. And as you said, we have this moment and you have a lot of energy right now, given even just something as recent as the passage of Measure J, where voters are really looking at these institutions and going for remaking them in the interest of the public, in the interest of the public good in particular. With respect to that, I want to ask you a little bit about this grant for reconnecting MacArthur Park. You are a huge fan of MacArthur Park, I know, as I am, as a lot of the constituents are. This is a critical part of our neighborhood, and yet for many years it has sat neglected, and in fact there is a real fentanyl crisis that is impacting MacArthur Park and the Westlake area. Maybe tell us a little bit about plans going forward with this grant and how it's maybe a part of remaking MacArthur Park for, once again, that public good.
That's a great question. Thank you. We've been doing a lot of work in that area. With this $500,000 MacArthur Park grant to reconnect the park, we really wanted to find a way to give that street, that space, back to the community. MacArthur Park, Westlake, Pico Union are some of the densest neighborhoods compared to any part of the city or county, and it's also majority apartments, which means people don't have front yards, they don't have backyards, they don't have cute plazas in their homes to go and enjoy. So we want to create that for this community. And so the that grant is a planning grant to help us begin to design, to do the analysis, the estimates of what it'll look like and what it'll take for us to begin to close that street, Wilshire Boulevard, to reconnect MacArthur Park. We're going to start closing it intermittently for like festivals or different types of events next year, and just kind of begin to test the waters. And also at the same time, though, because it's going to be cute. It's going to be real cute. There's going to be lights. There's going to be all sorts of things that are going to make this one of the largest pedestrian walkways in the entire city of Los Angeles in MacArthur Park. And so people are going to want to come, which also is a double-edged sword of, like, we're going to have to do a lot of labor to make sure that we support our local businesses so they're not gentrified out, because that's how beautiful it's going to be. And so we have plans to work with EWDD to make sure we can support these businesses so that we can develop without the displacement of people. And so that's one factor, and that's what we want to do to reconnect the park. But at the same time, we also have what we're already moving forward, which is our MacArthur Park overdose prevention strategy, which includes a lot of street cleaning. It includes working with the vendors on the MacArthur Park train station platform. It includes having a street medicine team for that area to respond to overdoses, to prevent overdoses. We have a working group where we've brought all the service providers in the MacArthur Park area together to figure out, okay, what is the calendar that y'all come with, so we're not chopping up these services and people fall through the cracks. Let's coordinate more. We have, like, I would love to see a vending machine of, like, a naloxone out there. We have places next to MacArthur Park, for example, called Yoshinoya Alley, that has existed for a long time, which is a place where a lot of people go and use drugs, and it's an open-air drug use, just alley. Why haven't we done anything about it? So we're bringing the resources, we're trying to find the resources to build a respite center so that people who are on the street right now, actively using or just need a place to go, where they can go and seek refuge and rest. And we're trying to find that location in MacArthur Park as well. So cleaning the streets, providing the services, coordinating the services, because it's also one of the locations where, yeah, you see a lot of open-air drug use, but that's equating to a lot of overdoses. We get a handful of overdoses every day in the MacArthur Park area. That is a huge strain on our resources that we could prevent, but also we can respond to in different ways, such as mobile overdose prevention teams. So we have like a strategy that we're working, that we really just want to bring these resources here. And it's moving forward. It's going to take a little bit of time, but we want to invest a lot in MacArthur Park. Again, though, without the displacement. Because MacArthur Park, also Westlake and Chinatown, and obviously all across the city, but because of these neighborhoods' proximity to downtown, like, these properties are hot. You have lots that are selling for just dirt lots for sale for over $12 million. So it's also something else to consider, but we're trying to do work to protect people and keep them in the neighborhood, also through what we have that we call our community advocacy team. And so our community advocacy team works with small businesses, works with tenants, to make sure that everybody can stay.
Yeah, I appreciate this response, and I think it's a really jam-packed item because, again, we're talking about moving funds without displacing people. Mm-hmm. We have this familiarity with gentrification and its impact on our neighborhoods and how revitalizing or city revitalization, neighborhood revitalization, has often led to displacement of small businesses, the policing of our community, ultimately their incarceration and the whitewashing of these spaces for a whole new clientele for investors who, as you said, have huge gains to make from this hot real estate. So I think it is a conversation that you are inviting more of the community towards because this naturally cannot be solely city-led. It has to be, as you said, a coordinated process. And I think even Stephanie Wiggins at Metro, I think of the Westlake MacArthur Park terminal there, they need to play a role just as well in how this moves forward successfully.
100%, because, you know, the Metro station was cleaned up in the inside, but now people have now are seeking refuge at Yoshinoy Alley or seeking refuge next to our small businesses. So there's a lot we got to do there, but we can't do it and then displace people.
Councilmember Hernandez, I have really enjoyed this conversation with you, and we are, of course, pressed for time, but I have just a few more questions for you, very quick. You endorsed two new candidates for LA City Council going forward. This, once again, I think really breaks with convention. Can you tell me a little bit about your endorsements for CD 10 as well as CD 14 and how, rather than going with tradition, you really see an opportunity for something new at LA City Hall, including through what folks would call outsiders?
Yes, yeah, so I endorsed Isabel Jurado for CD 14, and I dual endorsed in CD 10 Pastor Eddie Anderson and current Councilwoman Heather Hutt. And the reason why I endorsed these individuals is, you know, I'm on the inside now. I see what it takes to move my colleagues to vote on issues. I see the lack of expertise that we need on the council. And I believe that these candidates have the expertise that will be super beneficial to our decision making here. I think all the individuals I have endorsed are we can take them to a place where they're going to vote for our tenants, vote to support our small businesses. Isabel has a phenomenal background in being a tenants attorney, in working with small businesses and keeping them in their locations and other work like that. Pastor Eddie Anderson has done years and years of work in building power within the community, working with LA Voice to pass campaigns like Measure J that would benefit our community. And Councilwoman Heather Hutt, it's been just an honor to be able to work next to her. I think that, all the circumstances aside, like, she has really met the moment in her role, and I see her growing. And, you know, it's really hard in here when you have people who aren't on the same, who aren't values aligned with you, who are willing to make trade-offs and promises, like, who haven't been accountable for harm that they have done. Or there's also people who are running that is more of the same of that. Right. You know, there are people running in 14, different faces, essentially it's the same person.
And there's a lot of rage in 14 about that. There's a lot of outrage about just that same system that
And I hope that they take it beyond rage, you know? Like, there's an election in March. CD 14 needs to figure it out because they didn't figure it out for when the harm happened. And there wasn't a campaign that got off the ground that was strong enough to
challenge the incumbency.
To challenge him, but to recall. Right. CD14 didn't get it together for a recall. They need to get it together for this election because CD14 is the district that has the highest number of eviction filings compared to any district. Oh, yeah. They get millions upon millions of dollars in discretionary funding because of downtown and some of these other institutions within the district that help support their discretionary fund. Like, I was just looking at an arts funding line item. So when a developer has to pay for art, and if they don't pay for the art, then it goes into a fund so the district can put it in the art. They have over $3 million just from art development fees. That is just one line item. So District 14 has so much how many resources it could really help its constituents that I hope they get activated. And I'm sorry for going on this long one, but it's like, y'all, electoral politics, you have to get engaged. As frustrating as it is, This is the system that we exist in, and there's millions upon millions of dollars being discussed every week. And you're missing out because you don't have someone that represents your needs. So please, CD14, get it together, vote, step up. We need to have someone who's going to help us get good policies over the finish line. And I really think that Isabel is that person.
And what they need is to take 50% or more than 50%. So yes. what this is about ends up being that the race begins in March. We want to finish it in November. We don't want the race to conclude as early as this March, because that is a missed opportunity for at least another 4 years. And then there are much bigger implications after that. So there is a lot of pressure on there. And I think folks on this side of town need to hear about this pressure, actually.
Yeah, because they're missing out. They're missing out a lot on City Hall.
Just one final question for you with respect, once again, to convention and breaking with convention, actually. You joined just about a little over a dozen city officials, California officials, calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Tell me a little bit about this and how you came to this decision, especially because the vast majority of elected officials still haven't done so.
What I'll say to that is that, you know, you can look back in history and see how you responded to moments like these. That's what I asked myself. Like, how are we going to respond when it's blatantly in front of us what is occurring? I have unfortunately been on social media too much. I've seen too many videos, seen too many dismembered bodies of all ages, and it's happening on our dime. And so I think we just need peace. I call for peace like all over the world, but like I hope that there's a way that this particular war and horrific actions could just cease. And there was a video of this young Palestinian boy who was talking about how happy he was the day the ceasefire started. And that really got to me. Like, he was so happy. And it's probably one of the only happy videos that I saw come out of this. Just that one moment of freedom that he got.
Yeah, and in the end, all of this is a moment in history. All of this is what we look back on. And with that in mind, I really have to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. It's been a true pleasure. And I will let you move on with the rest of city business, because I think you have a district to see.
Thank you, JT. We're trying our best.
Oh, yeah, thank 100%.
You. It's Jimbo times.